What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Darius Dale is the founder and CEO of 42 Macro, the leading macro risk management advisor. In this conversation, we talk about what's going on in the macro economy, what's happening in the financial markets, how Darius is looking at various metrics, and also what you at home should be thinking about as you invest your capital. I really enjoyed this conversation with Darius, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Exodus, the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet. They offer beautiful, user-friendly blockchain products that sync across all of your devices, making it easier to send, receive, and exchange over 150 or more crypto assets in one place. And with world-class customer service available to you 24/7, Exodus always has your back. But the fun doesn't stop with staking and trading. They recently launched a new NFT marketplace where you can buy and sell your favorite NFTs on the Solana network. By partnering with the popular NFT platform Magic Eden, they're offering the full Monty on verified collections, with more added every single day. Ready to check it out for yourself? Run, don't walk, over to exodus.com/pomp for your free download today. Again, if you want the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet, go to exodus.com/pomp today. This episode is brought to you by 8Sleep. 8Sleep is the single best product that I have purchased over the last 3 years. It completely changed my life. I'm not joking. Pay attention. The Pod Pro cover, which goes over your mattress by 8Sleep, is the most advanced solution on the market for thermoregulation. It pairs dynamic cooling and heating with biometric tracking. You can go to 8sleep.com/pomp to check out the Pod Pro cover, and you save $150 at checkout. They currently ship within the United States, Canada, and the UK. Now, I told you, it changed my life. It helps me sleep deeper, helps me sleep longer. I feel much more refreshed, and I have better energy. You want to know how I have relentless energy every single day? It's because I sleep on an 8Sleep. Seriously, go check it out, 8sleep.com/pomp today. This episode is brought to you by DeFi Technologies. DeFi Technologies represents what's next in the digital economy. They're providing simplified, trusted access to crypto, decentralized finance, and Web3 investment opportunities. Institutions and investors can gain diversified, secure, compliant, and easily tradable access to a diversified set of industry-leading equity products and protocols through a single stock purchase on a regulated exchange. DeFi Technologies is currently listed on the U.S. exchange at DEFTF stock ticker and the Canadian NEO exchange at DEFI. For more information or to subscribe to receive company updates and financial information, visit their website at defi.tech. I'm really excited about what these guys are doing. I've become an advisor to the business, and I highly suggest you go check them out. Go to their website at defi.tech today. All right, let's get in this episode. I hope you guys enjoyed this one.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
We happen to not only have me and John here today to talk about this. He has not been sitting here the entire time. He just got here, to make that clear. He was not just looking at us monologuing for 30 minutes.
I have been for 30 seconds. I'm impressed.
But we have Darius here with us. A lot of stuff going on.
Dude, lots going on. Let's just start by saying, you know, like we talked about last week, we have a lot of stuff to be thankful for and grateful for in this country. Kind of just seeing the American flag behind John, just kind of really thankful for our military. Like, we don't have to worry about this kind of stuff. Obviously with the people of Ukraine are going through right now, it's terrifying, and our hearts and prayers are out with them. So, you know, it's just going to be a tough situation for a while, because it doesn't seem like Putin is of the mind to acquiesce and use the diplomatic measures to accomplish his goals.
When you think about the financial market impacts, let's start, maybe we talked a little bit about oil before you got here. Over $100 a barrel. Obviously, Russia's making money by being one of the largest oil producers. What's the impact on Americans? Should we just expect gasoline prices to continue to explode? It's up 50% year over year. Unfortunately, the media is incorrect in that them claiming that inflation or high gas prices is because of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. the Ukraine crisis started, you know, maybe in the last 60 days. Yeah. So the 2 years before that obviously did have an impact. But I do think that it would be fair to say, hey, moving forward, a material increase in gasoline could be attributed to this situation in combination with kind of Russia and Saudi Arabia not increasing production. Is that kind of your read on this?
Yeah, for start, you absolutely. So there's a lot to unpack financial markets wise. So I'll start with gas. The fact that crude oil is up as much as it is today, it was up at 8% this morning, or up 8% this morning when I checked, could be up more or less now, but tells you that there is this sort of concept about a geopolitical premium baked into the oil price. Mm-hmm. And it very clearly is rebutting that today. There was not a geopolitical premium baked into the oil price. Otherwise, you wouldn't see the kind of price action that we have today. Number two, it's very likely to be persistent to the extent that we continue to have geopolitical conflict. And as I said earlier, there's no exit ramp for this conflict anytime soon, because it strikes me that Putin's goals are directly at odds with the Biden administration. So somebody's going to have to blink, and usually there takes a lot more pain for these major powers to blink, unfortunately. One thing I thought was really interesting, to me, the most interesting thing that's happened in the last 24 hours is the big decline in the real interest rate here in the U.S. This morning is probably the biggest one-day decline ever, if I had to go back and look. But the 10-year TIPS yield, which is inflation-adjusted treasury bond yield, declined 25 basis points day over day. That was like a 40% move in terms of the percentage change of the move. And it's directly at odds with what happened yesterday. So yesterday we saw bond yields rise because the sort of specter of war would tax the already depressed productive capacity of the economy. You could actually see more inflation as a function of this. But then today, I think the market is sort of realizing, oh no, wait, this is actually bearish because we're going to talk about $100 oil, we're going to $110 oil, going to $120 oil, and ultimately the negative impact that that's likely to have on the U.S. consumer and by extension, the global economy.
When you start to think about the Fed, let's go there.
Your favorite topic.
Yeah, well, because I do think that whether people like it or not, the Fed is ultimately the decider of what happens to asset prices right now.
100%.
And you could argue that that's always been true. But I think right now, when you get uncertainty, when you get chaos, when you get complexity in the system, and you're looking for signal, a lot of times if you just zero in on where does the chain of events start, the Fed usually is the originator of a lot of action. Not all of it, but a lot of it.
Totally.
Asset prices, especially risk assets, have sold off over the last 4 months or so because everyone thinks the Fed's going to raise, they're going to raise the interest rate, they're going to raise the interest rate. As much as I think JP Morgan said 9 times over the next year. Yeah. Obviously, I think that was probably a little
aggressive.
Strategists
are tripping over themselves to get the highest number.
Who could say 11? Who could say 11 and not get fired? You won't write 11? I'll buy you a beer.
Oh, you wrote 11.
like literally, I feel like that's what's going on there. Right? So, all right, so 9, I think people are like, all right, that's the extreme upside. But I do think that if you went and talked to most people, no raise to 50 basis points in March was kind of the aperture of like reality. Mm-hmm. And I do think that most people would say 25 basis points to 50 basis points as a raise in March. Mm-hmm. 48 hours ago, I literally think that's what people thought. I don't know if a lot of people think that now in 48 hours with, literally the move, kind of the chess move of Russia saying, hey, we're going to go invade Ukraine. Does that change, or do you still think that they have to raise in order to still address the issues here in the United States?
Oh, no. The Fed's hands are very much tied in terms of monetary tightening for a couple of reasons. One, there has not been a big enough feedback sort of mechanism in financial markets in terms of tightening financial conditions for the Fed to suggest that somehow they're going to achieve their inflation mandate or somehow they need to defend their maximum and inclusive employment mandate at this particular juncture. We have not seen enough carnage. Credit spreads are, 400 basis points over on high yield, roughly thereabouts. They could double before you actually start to see a real big hit to economic activity as a function of that. So that's number one. And then number two, and this is something that, I think is kind of the second order thinking, which is if the Fed does not raise, just given all the tightening that's been piced into, forwards curves, then they effectively amount to easing, which I'm not sure that the central bank wants to send a signal that they're easing at this particular juncture. You know what I mean? Because it's already priced in, so you almost have to do it, right? If you don't do it, then the markets will take it out. And that's how markets will function and respond to that. So they're already on the path to losing their credibility if they haven't already. Certainly they've lost it with a large pocket of investors. They might lose it with all of us if they don't at least try to start normalizing monetary policy.
I'm going to read you a portion of a DM. I got I reached out to somebody and I said, hey, what do you think about this yesterday? It's somebody who has a very unique kind of intersection. They understand some of the geopolitical stuff. They understand some of the macroeconomy stuff. They understand Bitcoin, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And he sent me back a number of really intelligent points. I don't want to say who it is because I didn't ask him. But one of them says Putin's making a play on collapsing the dollars because he can see the massive spread between CPI and fixed income yields. And driving energy prices higher will put the ineptitude of the Fed and ECB on full display mm-hmm. right to the moment they were going to pretend to raise rates. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that like it's a pretty astute, you know, identification of there's other things going on. But one of the impacts or one of the reasons to take these actions is to basically just say like, no, you're not. You're not going to raise rates. Like, everything you just said is not going to happen.
Yeah.
Is that kind of like what you're anticipating now? Like, do we get a interest rate raise in 2022 now? Like, did we go from 9 as the extreme to 0?
Some poor analyst is going to get fired for publishing 11 today. But anyway, no, I know what you mean. So let me start by saying whoever wrote that is an extremely astute investor. That's been my take on this the whole time, which is Putin being the sort of thug that he is, but a very educated, smart thug, understands the pain points, right, across the global economy, pain points in the global financial system. And why would you not wait until inflation's at a 40-year high to invade Ukraine and cause trouble in financial markets? Because you know, at the bare minimum, you're going to put the Fed in a conundrum. At the bare maximum, you're going to expose them and cause them to lose their credibility. And so, you know, this is, you know, it's sort of like, I can't even think of a good analogy, but it's the former KGB operative in him that chose to wait until now, you know, just on the eve of the Fed's normalization agenda, because again, their credibility is at stake here. Bullard said as much a couple weeks ago. Obviously, the data would suggest that the credibility is at stake as well. So I think Putin is really enjoying himself right now because, quite frankly, he's got the upper hand.
When you think about his, what's the best way to say this? His position in the world. Most people, I think, were kind of just like, oh, I was told not to like Vladimir Putin. So like, you know, bad guy, right? Mm-hmm. If you start to learn about Russia, one of the books that probably has had the most influence in terms of my view of how some of the financial markets was Red Notice, Bill Browder's whole book, right, about the financial markets and kind of American investors, Russian investors. He mentions Putin in there as like just like a competitor basically in the market. And then next thing you know, becomes president. China seems to be like, somebody just put like more pieces on the chessboard. And there's obviously the concern that like China says like, oh, well, if Russia can invade Ukraine and like you guys are just going to sanction them, like Taiwan, come on over, right? Yeah. And so like whether that happens or not, what remains to be seen. But it does feel like those two countries, and they explicitly are talking about it, they want to get off the US dollar, they're starting to work together more, et cetera. Like, is there a world where we just get a bifurcation and it's literally like, for better or worse terminology, I'll say like Western world and Eastern world. And basically in that bifurcation, literally there's two separate circular economies or insular economies that maybe are like frenemies. So maybe there's some crossover or, you know, selling of goods and services or whatever. But for the most part, like Russia and China, you know, try to produce and consume each other's goods and that works. And then the Western world does the same thing for themselves. And we don't have this like globalization happening.
100%. I mean, this has been happening since 2014.
Yeah.
You know, sort of Luke Groman over at Forest for the Trees is kind of a expert on a lot of these types of topics. Him and Jeff Snyder. And you know, but they'll tell you both of them, you're really going back 5, 6, 7 years, which is the world splintered. Jeff Snyder would say, hey, the world splintered in 2007 with the breaking of, you know, sort of the Eurodollar network and the credit creation therein, or at least the former way of doing things. And, you know, Luke Grumman would suggest that the sort of global monetary system splintered in 2014 when the rest of the world really stopped sort of sterilizing our debts and deficits by stopping the accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, dollar denominated foreign exchange reserves. And so since 2014, I would argue, I'm probably more in loose camp on this. Since 2014, that drive, this sort of it's a realization amongst emerging market and amongst other, you know, kind of Eastern, if you will, central banks to say, hey, look, this system isn't working for us. The cost of capital is too high. The availability of capital is too scarce. We're not able to grow and meet our development needs, our goals to bring folks out of poverty and things, all that good stuff, quickly enough, because the supply and price of dollar denominated credit, which is the global, obviously global, most credit is denominated in dollars globally, it's too hard to obtain. And so I think we're very much on a path. I've always thought we were on a path towards bifurcated monetary systems. It's unclear at the speed of which, if that's all going to happen at once. And these things tend to happen like slowly, slowly, slowly. There's an event here, an event there, an event here. And then there's usually a big event that sort of catalyzes the big change. I'm not convinced that this is the big event that catalyzes the big change, but I am convinced that both Putin and President Xi of China are well aware that this is the path that we're on, and they're going to take every liberty to sort of perpetuate this, because ultimately it is a better outcome for them, which is to get off from underneath the sort of the foot of the dollar system.
So while we've been talking, Putin's made some more comments.
Man is on fire today.
Which is interesting, because I think exactly what you're saying, they've publicly talked about this, right? I remember we pulled it up yesterday. In 2018, I wrote a piece, and it was like Putin was at a conference. He basically was like, the U.S. dollar system sucks. It's too expensive. It's dangerous. We got to get off this thing. Like, He wasn't hiding anything, right?
No,
he was saying it right there in the conference. But he just said, Russia remains part of global economy. We do not plan to damage the system that we belong to. And he says that his partners or Russia's partners should understand that and should not push them out from the system. So again, we get into this, I'm going to call it gamesmanship. That might be too positive of a word, but I don't mean it in a positive way as much as maybe geopolitical chess is a better way to describe it. Mm-hmm. Where you get like, what are they saying? What does it mean? And then what are they doing?
Yeah.
And it feels like this like constant, don't kick us out from the system. We're part of the system. We want to be part of the US dollar based, you know, financial system. Like, it's all the right things to say. But it seems like they've positioned themselves for a different world.
I have a great analogy for this.
All right,
man.
Let's hear it.
So good. So one of my guilty pleasures of being a engaged man now. Is watching Vanderpump Rules on Bravo with my fiance. And this is so reminiscent of Jax being a total asshole to Brittany because he wants her to break up with him. So he's not the bad guy for breaking up with her, this like total angelic sweetheart. And finally he just snaps and breaks up with her.
Yep.
And so this to me, it seems like he's like kicking and screaming, trying to hopefully gets pushed out of the system so he can finally say to China, hey, look, we need to, advance this pretty aggressively, right? To me, I also think in terms of this bifurcation process, it's not going to come without the loss of human life. It's not going to come without, great financial and economic costs, right? It's stasis is generally preferred if you're thinking about, generating profits, right? And then we have big change, it makes the whole thing kind of slow down and grind to a halt. And so it's a lot to lose for all parties involved to make this transition. But the reality is that I think the folks that are sort of on the wrong side of the dollar system, if you will, Russia, China, a lot of emerging markets, I think they've gotten to the point where they're like, there's a lot to lose if we stay. Right. And so they're kind of kicking and screaming, hopefully to get dumped so we can go, really transition at a more expeditious pace. And more importantly, explain it to their citizens. Right. They got to market this to Chinese citizens, to Russian citizens as, hey, look, see, they kicked us out of the SWIFT system, the global dollar system. We got to transition. You got to deal with this pain for now, but we got to make this transition. And I think they're looking for political air cover to do that. But who knows if we'll give it to them at this particular juncture again.
I'm going to start asking you about stuff you may not know about, so feel free to just say pass.
Yeah,
there was a great tweet this morning from a WSB chairman who said, if you invested $10,000 in the Russian stock market yesterday, today you'd have $5,000. It went down 50%, right?
Yeah.
And so how do the stock markets trade in these situations? I saw somebody else, I forget who tweeted it. And you know, you can judge whether people should tweet, not tweet, whatever in these situations, certain things. But I saw a tweet yesterday that basically went back and looked at the Gulf War, Desert Storm, Iraq, Afghanistan. And I forget there was one other one, maybe Crimea or something. Yeah. And it was basically like buy the invasion, mm-hmm. right? Like basically when something like this happens, stocks take off and like buy the stocks, even if there's some short-term price decline, because ultimately it ends up being like a pretty good financial decision. Mm-hmm. Again, serious situation, people's lives are at risk. But if you're looking at it from a financial market standpoint, that's one perspective.
Yeah, for sure.
Same time, Russian stock market went down 50%. Yeah. And so like how, if at all, do you have thoughts around like the stock market of the countries involved versus like US based assets in these types of environments?
What do you mean by US based assets? So
US stocks, US commodity markets, et cetera.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I think the problem is we're sort of, we can't sort of narrow risk management down to this one singular catalyst, right? Like there's geopolitical concerns that may or may not get resolved over a short to medium term time horizon. There's the growth concerns that, you know, we don't think are being respected enough, broadly speaking, irrespective of geopolitical concerns. I mean, $100 crude oil, consumer confidence on a 10, 12 year low, you know, all these sort of things are telling you there's problems, you know, mostly through the real income, declining real income front. Those are problems that are, you know, would be here without Putin. And there's obviously the 40 year high in inflation and then what the Fed's going to do about it. So there's sort of four kind of buckets to bucket these all in. Geopolitical concerns, obviously none of us is sort of, you know, at Putin on speed dial. I'm not sure if we had Putin on speed dial, we'd actually be getting good information because this guy's a chess grandmaster, right? And so, you know, the reality is you're probably right. I think isolating that variable, that factor, geopolitical concerns, you're probably right to buy the invasion most, you know, 9 times out of 10. The problem is where we are in this current market cycle, this current market environment, we're still coming off some pretty aggressive valuations, just looking at, you know, equity and credit market valuations, both domestically and abroad. Mostly domestically, we're a lot more overvalued than our peers globally here in the U.S. That's an issue. Obviously, the policy normalization agenda is an issue, particularly in the context of the growth outlook. Normally, I said this, you know, saying this to him blue in the face. This is the latest the Fed has ever waited to start tightening policy in any business cycle. Like in terms, at least by the letter of the law, in terms of, you know, the level of the unemployment rate, which is how economists date the business cycle, was whether the economy starts going up or down. And so it's just a weird setup. You know, it's a gross setup. I said it yesterday. It's gross. You know, everywhere you look, there's a headwind. And this is why stocks are going down. This is why Bitcoin, Ethereum, crypto are going down. This is why NFTs are finally starting to crash. It's not a good setup for taking risk. There will be a good setup for taking risks at some point in the medium term once the Fed realizes the growth outlook has become so challenged that they have to back off. I just don't know that we're there yet. We haven't seen enough data. We haven't seen enough of a tightening of financial conditions for them to credibly back off of tightening. They can back off of tightening at any point in time, but I fear that they fear they're going to lose their credibility if they do so.
So Sam Bankman-Fried had this whole thread last night about stocks, Bitcoin, war, et cetera. He basically talked about, you know, it makes sense that stocks are down in the kind of very immediate term, Bitcoin as well. People are selling things to get cash, uncertainty, liquidity. All of that, yeah, liquidity, et cetera. But he also talked about, let's start with destabilizing Eastern European currencies and the Eastern European financial systems, which means that they might look for alternatives. If you were in Ukraine right now, where would you trust your money? So like that was one of his like early points. And I think this is really fascinating because ultimately we usually think about people seeking alternatives to their local currency because of undisciplined monetary and fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. Your currency's failing. Shit, I got to get something else. I want dollars. I can't get dollars for whatever reason. My bank's going to confiscate it. It's dangerous in the black market. It's expensive, whatever.
Totally.
Screw it. What's on the internet? Let me go do something there. Or let me get physical gold. Hope somebody doesn't confiscate it as I'm leaving, whatever.
Yeah, totally.
When you start thinking about it from a war perspective, when you start thinking about it from literally a, is my government going to be around? There's reports all morning that Russian forces are trying to literally take the government. They're trying to install new leadership. They're trying to take over the Chernobyl plant. Like, I mean, this is like an invasion of on the invasion scale, this is like true invasion. Right?
This is rules. Yeah.
This isn't like, hey, we shot some rockets and like, did we do something? No,
they drove tanks to the Capitol.
Yes. Correct. And so it does beg the question of like, okay, if you're one of the thousands of people that we pulled up that are literally leaving Kiev, what do you do with your wealth? Do you leave it in a Ukrainian bank? Do you put some gold in the trunk and hope to God no one stops you? Do you hope that you have enough physical cash to put in your pocket and that you prepared for this situation? Like, these are real things. And if you're sitting there thinking about this, like, it's not that, oh, I'm going to get rich with Bitcoin. Like, whether it's stable coins, Bitcoin, whatever asset, there's like a very real consequence to having these assets now or an advantage to having them.
Yeah. So starters, obviously digital assets are a cheap and not cheap, certainly an effective solution for people in these trying times. I'm not sure that everybody in Ukraine at this particular juncture has the ability to remove their money out of banks and put them in digital asset space. But to the extent that you're already trapped in that financial system, buy stocks. Like the blue chip Ukrainian businesses, and that may be an oxymoron. I'm not too familiar with how rock and rolling Ukraine's economy normally is. But to the extent that there are blue chip businesses, you know, like the best grocery store in Ukraine, you know, the Uber of Ukraine, you know, all those kinds of companies, they're not going anywhere. You know, they're still going to operate and exist. They might be under different leadership. They might be under Putin's buddy running the company in 6 months, but you know, they're still going to be generating capital, generating profits, and ultimately servicing the Ukraine economy. So if I was, I would be much more concerned about having money in physical Ukrainian dollars. What's their currency? Ukrainian zloty or I don't know how the hell I knew that. That's ridiculous.
It's because you're smart.
Yeah. Well, I'm such a nerd. Anyway, but no, like you don't want your money in the local currency. So clearly stocks tend to inflate when there's a hyperinflation episode, which again, hyperinflation in my book or in a lot of economist books is defined by a loss of confidence in the currency, not necessarily by a certain level or threshold of inflation, but rather an actual absolute collapse in the currency. And you could see a collapse in the currency if the regime was to change, or if there was this fear that the regime was going to change, right? And so you're definitely going to buy assets that Russians themselves with Russian rubles would want to buy. That would be the best trade.
John, before you ask your question, John Kerry gave an interview, I guess, this morning, and he said, I hope that Vladimir Putin helps us stay on track for our climate goals. It's like,
wow, geez Louise, man.
That wasn't on the bingo card.
Not at all.
What questions do you have?
Yeah, I agree that like Ukrainian businesses, the infrastructure will be there. Yeah. No matter the leadership, like they will eventually come somewhat relative back to normal, whoever's in power. Mm-hmm. The country itself, though, will operate.
Yeah, totally.
What do people around the world, talk about US, Ukraine citizens, Russian, obviously everyone's very fearful right now, right? Buying, they don't know what's going to happen in the future with the stock market. Is it right to be fearful, or is this the time where, hey, kind of be greedy when others are fearful and vice versa? Like, it's okay to be fearful right now? Or what are your thoughts around that?
I tend to think that fear and greed are two emotions that cause you to lose the most money in financial markets. So generally speaking, if you can, obviously it's impossible because we're all human, right? We all make more decisions that we need to make in terms of, you know, risk managing our portfolios and things of that nature. But I think it's best to just make calculated bets based on where we are in the various cycles. Again, there's geopolitics, which is hard to ever truly handicap and gauge. Yeah. But you can understand where you are in the growth cycle. You can understand where you are in the inflation cycle. You can understand where you are in the monetary and fiscal policy cycles. And then also you can understand where you are in the valuation cycle. And all of those cycles right now, all five of them, are moving in the wrong direction. And so to me, I think if you're saying sort of there's blood in the streets by, yeah, over a long enough time horizon, risk assets, you know, stocks, crypto, all this stuff goes up in price over time. One, because there's an expansion of the money supply. But more importantly, there's an expansion of the human supply. And obviously, we're going to create economic activity and economic growth just as a function of, you know, having babies and, you know, being alive and advances in medicine. And so that stuff, if you have a long enough time horizon, it's always a great time to buy. An all-time high is a great time to buy if you have a long enough time horizon. But the problem is, most people, particularly people at or near retirement, cannot afford to suffer material drawdowns. And this is where the whole concept of risk management comes into play. It's not about people who can, you know, hodl Bitcoin, you know, for 20, 30 years, which is what most people should be doing, obviously. It's about the people who, the reason we see selling ever is the people who cannot afford a big drawdown, get nervous about their asset allocation and start to make decisions that broadly impact financial markets. And so that's what we're dealing with now. That's what we'll be dealing with for the rest of human time until we have, you know, some sort of universal, I'm certainly not advocating this, so don't shoot me, some sort of like universal retirement program or basic income, or, but obviously we're probably, you know, that's many, 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 many years away from occurring in the US if ever.
So have enough money to weather the storm, essentially, right? And time.
Well. And most people do not, right? The average person does not, right? The average person is a lot richer than they were prior to the pandemic. But I think inflation has taken a real big bite out of that for the median to below median consumer from an income perspective. So but I think we're probably, for a lot of people, we're worse off than where we started. And for a lot of people, we're slightly better off and getting less better off by the day in terms of declines in asset prices.
Gotcha. Do you think inflation goes up from here?
It's not scheduled to. Let me answer this question in the most stupid, wonky economist way possible. There's a high probability that it decelerates and starts to decelerate. We're starting to get to the point in the process, particularly once you get to March, where inflation, the base effects really start to kick in. And so you need to see a substantial acceleration in the current trend growth rate of inflation, the sequential rate of inflation, to maintain the same level of inflation on a year-over-year basis. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that once inflation starts coming down on a year-over-year basis, that inflation is under control. You could be sort of maintaining the same very elevated level of inflation, sequential, momentum. It's just that the year-over-years are going down because, you know, we already did it last year, basically. And so I think that is a high likelihood of occurring. Prior to today and prior to oil, you know, basically going from $90 a barrel to $100 a barrel in one day, there was a high probability that we were going to lose inflation momentum. So not only were we going to win on the year over year, we were going to win on the sequential and the momentum. And the Fed would be able to say quicker, sooner, that, hey, look, we got this thing under control. Now it's a function of this move in commodity prices, because it's not just crude oil. And more importantly, what a war could do in terms of taxing the productive capacity of the economy. Like, what if, you know, we might not be sending a ton of troops there. What if Germany and France send a bunch of troops there? You know, what if Ukraine mobilizes and Russia mobilizes more? There's a lot of things that could happen that could actually, you know, sort of really become an additional tax on the productive capacity of the global economy. And if that occurs, then we're likely to see, you know, something that looks more like what we saw kind of in the fall of this most recent year, which is supply chain disruptions. And so if that continues to happen, then we're going to have a big problem on the inflation front. That will be a secondary problem relative to what we already have.
Inflation, I believe, will, if we continuously kind of step in, go to war, I think it will get worse based off the amount of money that we're going to have to print.
Totally.
But for the Fed, it seems like they don't have to raise rates, right? Like they would have, I guess, right? So they were expecting everyone from 3 to 9 interest rate hikes. But it seems like it's almost being priced in. Everything got overvalued a little bit. Yeah. And it's kind of coming back to normal as what we're seeing now, right? Yeah. So are they going to still raise in March, you think?
Yeah, no. I think the Fed is at the worst. Again, I think I said this last week. The U.S. economy is already sort of on this slow, but in my opinion, deliberate road towards recession, right? We've had persistent negative real income growth on a per capita basis for months now. And so, you know, how you can have a economy growing on a real basis at all in the absence of stimulus with that dynamic is beyond me and beyond the math of anybody operating Excel or Python or any other program. And so, you know, if the Fed did nothing, it was likely that we were going to have an economy sort of just decay naturally on its way to recession until we got inflation under control, until we had a better realignment of demand with the productive capacity of the economy. The Fed is, in order to control inflation, is effectively trying to speed that process up, right? You know, they think they have the ability to sort of get us right to the brink of recession just enough to get inflation under control, but then to make this perfect pivot and, you know, get us stave off recession and make sure that the labor market doesn't take it on the chin. History is very, very unkind to the Fed and their ability to do that. And I think they probably get better every time, right? They're more responsive. There's more data. There's more people. There's more Twitter. There's more everything. There's more information, right? So they're probably going to be better at it than they have been historically. But that doesn't mean they have the ability to turn the U.S. economy on a dime, to turn the global economy on a dime. There's all these dynamics that happen in terms of credit creation, off balance sheet, in the shadow finance sector, non-bank entities, you know, that the Fed doesn't necessarily have a real true control over. They have signaling power over, but they don't necessarily have true control over. So I just, it's kind of wrapping this up. I think the key risk here is that we could slide into recessions, albeit on a slower pace, if the Fed does nothing and loses its credibility in the process, or we could slide towards recession or even into recession if the Fed does something to rein in inflation. To me, I think the first outcome longer term is much worse, because once the central bank loses credibility, S&P goes from, I don't know, 4,000 to 1,000. Like right now, so much of the S&P 500's valuation is a function of the Fed having credibility, right? And if the Fed just loses its credibility on inflation and its ability to control the business cycle, then I think there's a lot of valuation premium in U.S. assets in particular that is at risk.
Gotcha. We've got another guest that's going to join us here in a second. So I'll give you one last question, and then we got to move on.
Yeah, but, no worries.
The central bank of the United States has been the pristine lighthouse on the hill. If other countries begin to add other assets, move off of the U.S. dollar, et cetera, does that make them their job easier or harder, in the sense that one argument would be the more people that hold dollars, the more people that are holding assets that are impacted by dollars, the harder it is to essentially manage the monetary policy for billions and billions of people around the world in all these different economies. If, in the most extreme example, we just became an insular economy and they just had to manage the U.S. actual geographically constrained economy, is their job easier then?
Their job is easier, but everybody else's job is harder. You know, so that this sort of reliance on this global dollar system artificially depresses our interest rates, you know, kind of relative to what they probably should be based mm-hmm. on our credit metrics, you know. And the same thing's happening in Europe with, you know, the periphery in terms of Italy, Spain, all that stuff. So, you know, this dynamic where, you know, the U.S. dollar is the dominant currency, the global dollar system is the dominant monetary system, is really beneficial for us. And this is why I do believe that, you know, going back to my earlier comment, a transition to a sort of dual hybrid, you know, Western versus Eastern monetary system, which, oh, by the way, is in the Book of Revelation. Go check that out. you know, this transition is, you know, it's not going to be easy for anybody trying to usurp us, because we, I think our politicians and our people who control our military understand how important that is.
Where can we send people for 42 macro?
Absolutely.
Are you dropping data today?
Yeah. Oh, tons of data, man. Absolutely. So I'm on Twitter at 42macroddale, and then come check us out at 42macro.com. We specialize in helping make sure people don't lose all their money.
It's like the pitch of all pitches. Like, hey, maybe we can't make you rich, but we definitely can prevent you from losing all the money.
Yeah, no,
maybe along the way you might make some too.
Totally. There's half the time you just lick your finger in the air and buy the highest beta security and you'll make money. And the other half the time you need to pay attention to people like me and not lose all your money, so you can go back to the party when the party starts again.
That is incredible. The other thing real quick, I saw a tweet that said, well, if we go to war, we should send the vaccinated first, so all the troops are safe.
I was just like, we're still doing that, huh? Like,
I was just like,
oh man,
you know, it's one of these things. Like, I appreciate that people are trying to find some humor in a time that is obviously very, a lot of people are very stressed out, but still, yeah. It's just like, come on.
Absolutely. Well, boys, I'll catch you back here next week, man. Thank you, guys.
Next Thursday.
I'll see you,
buddy.
See you this weekend, actually.
All right. Ooh, this weekend. Ooh. Hey.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're looking to try to transition to get a new job in the Bitcoin or crypto industry, we've got you covered. Head over to pompscryptocourse.com. We've developed a curriculum with the top teams across the industry. It's a 3-week intensive training program with over 50 events packed into that 3-week time period. Go to pompscryptocourse.com to learn more, and I'll meet you guys for the next episode.